Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Session of the workshops. I've heard this session already, so I'm very privileged to hear it again. My name is Sandra Lawton. I'm a nurse consultant in dermatology and a fellow of the Queen's Nursing Institute. And welcome to everybody that's not in the room today, that's around the country listening to this wonderful conference that we've had today. I'm going to introduce two speakers to you today. The first speaker we have is Ben Bowers, and he's going to be talking to you about quality in community nursing. Ben is a community nurse by background, and he's also on the Department of Health Community Nursing Advisory Group, and also a member of the editorial board of the British Journal of Community Nursing. So be warned, he will be looking for writers. Now he's seen some names on the list. So over to you, Ben. And we'll have questions after Jan's session, because we obviously need to stream with our visitors from outside the room.
Hello, everyone. I've got my first session after tea break at the tired time of day, so I'll try and make quality as lively as I can for you all. So my background is as a district nurse. I'm a community cancer specialist nurse now, and I come from the quality angle from a practicing district nurse. So it's really based on what's going on in England. However, our colleagues in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland have very similar patterns. I'm going to talk about quality in what a quality measure looks like right now in practice, and a little bit about what it could be in the future. So quality, it's one of those words that's used an awful lot in practice. It gets bandied around an awful lot, but sometimes gets lost in translation. And it's worth going back to what it actually means to us as clinicians, what we perceive quality to be, and what our patients really think quality means, and what it means to them, what it means to their family and to the communities they live in. And then also, because the quality measures we use are going to be used to define how effective our service is, we need to be able to recognise what quality means to the commissioner. Now, hopefully, it means the same thing to everyone, but everyone comes to different priorities, different perspectives, and it's worth stepping back and just going, what do we all mean by this? And what is it we're going to measure and how are we going to measure it? Now, there's various work on it, but there's four key things which tends to be universally accepted by all stakeholders. And I'm going to talk about those today. And that is that there's healthcare efficiency, there's patient safety, patient satisfaction and experience, and then also people's outcomes. And all four things form what quality is. One alone becomes very subjective and it can enter into gaming. So healthcare efficiency first, and productivity. There's been an awful lot of work around district nursing around productivity, and I think there's an awful lot still to come. And it's using our time and our resources wisely. It really does have a strong function now in the modern healthcare environment, because we want to be spending time with patients. We don't want to ban six nurses doing lots of admin. We don't want to ban five nurses not being able to see patients because they're too busy trying to coordinate complicated care, where really they might be able to do that with some support from a colleague a lot quicker. There's all various reasons, but basically right now we use things such as Sequins, commissioning quality innovations. Now, these things have their place, but they tend to measure, do we see if someone's smoking? For example, are we a smoker? We don't look beyond that and say how effective is the quality of the intervention to help them not smoke anymore. So measuring quality is important, but one indicator. Just to say that actually, if when we're measuring efficiency, I'm going to give a quick example, and it worked really well. I was based in Hertfordshire in a team where there's several teams of district nurses who go into one central office. And my colleague, who was a team leader there, she'd looked at it and seen that all the teams were rushing in and out, going to two or three storerooms across this big community hospital. And actually, it was wasting everyone's time when they were trying to find out where something was. She got one storeroom near the front door, put all the equipment in there, saved a massive amount of time so people could spend time with patients. And that was an efficiency saving. Whether people spent more time with patients is debatable, but healthcare efficiency forms a part of efficiency, part of quality. Now, patient safety measures is another important part of quality measures. It focuses our attention on key areas of improvement. You probably have all used in practice a lot of incident forms of various descriptions. They're really key in developing patterns that we can spot when, say, medication errors are happening at a particular time in day, with staff are getting tired. Patient safety measures like that are really useful and a really key bit of intelligence to inform improving quality. Now, in England, we have the NHS safety thermometer. Forgive me if people know about it. I'll explain it for those who don't. Once a month in England, all hospital trusts and all community trusts, we basically, every patient we see that day, we look at four key things to find out, have these four harms happened to them? I.e., have they had a pressure ulcer? Have they, on a day we see them, or in 72 hours, fallen? Have they got a DVT or at risk of a DVT? That doesn't apply for community. And the fourth one is, have they got a urine tract infection related to the catheter? Now, that focuses our attention on things to make sure that the basics are done. It offers something which we can transparently see, so we can compare what's happening in other areas. However, the safety thermometer, although it allows us to say what's happening in a trust, we can't compare one trust to another trust because the patient groups are different. Now, patient safety thermometer works well along the sides of measurements of quality. But, for example, if we just measure our quality of our care on the amount of people who have pressure ulcers, what ends up happening is we put all our resources into preventing pressure ulcers. But what about the other people's needs? Are we meeting those? So safety measures have a place, but they also need to be within the control of us nursing staff to influence. In a hospital, we can influence, to some degree, the environment to make sure people fall. Show of hands, who believes that we as community nurses can prevent people from falling as nurses? Who believes we have complete influence on that? Who believes that the nurses in the wards have complete influence on that? No. So it's questionable evidence to say that these are the best indicators. Hopefully, as time goes by, we will start to know for the community what are the best indicators. One, for example, may be looking at patient medication error rates and measuring those. Patient outcomes, my particular favourite. Rather than saying, do we put a process of care in place for somebody, i.e. have we offered them a dementia screening, looking at something from the other angle and saying, has that person achieved the outcome that they want and that is best care for them? It moves away from putting structures of care in place, as discussed this morning, or processes, and actually leaves it up to us as clinicians and patients to decide what those outcome indicators are. We agree on the outcome indicators, but the way to get there. I'm going to give a quick example, and that is one of my colleagues here today. Sarah was in the team with me when we supported a lot of people in two surgeries to meet their end-of-life care needs. We worked with two surgeries as district nurses, and we discovered that, or we felt that with a lot of patients, we were being referred to support them in end-of-life care right at the last minute. Some were referred early on, some people were referred a lot later. And we wanted to change practice so we got in earlier and we could talk to people about their wishes and help them meet them. The outcome indicator was meeting somebody's wish to die in the place of their choice. But it was up to us how we got there. So we made 8 weekly regular meetings with the GPs and MDT for a gold standards framework. We had a 24-hour care service, which made a massive difference, meaning that we could access care when it was needed, especially out of hours. That was our structure. The processes that we put in place was we made sure we discussed care with people in a timely way. We made sure that we got just-in-case drugs in place and that it was effective input. So we met them at the right time. The GPs talked to them at the right time. and we communicated things effectively. And the whole thing shifted our perspectives into focusing on how could we improve care. As a result, 93% of the people who died in the 2 years that we audited died in the place of their choice. Of 50 people, 22 died in our homes. That was quite a massive improvement in care structure. So that was 44 people dying in our own homes compared to 27% locally. However, the limitation, and it's my last point, is patient experience. We felt that we gave everyone good end-of-life care, but we didn't have a way of evaluating what patients' families felt after the event. How could we improve the experience for them? We as clinicians may have thought they had a good death, but, you know, what did the family feel the experience was like? So Jan's going to talk more about patient experience and how it influences us, but very briefly, we deliver care in people's own homes. They're so vulnerable, the people we deliver care to. The Queen's Nursing Institute's report care at home identified an awful lot of people were satisfied with the care they receive. However, there was about 33% of people who responded to say they weren't satisfied. And there's a lot of learning that we need to take. So we need to ask the right questions. One question that's been used an awful lot is family and friends test. And we may well see that rolled out across the community. But I work as a community cancer specialist nurse. I support people who have got breast cancer or colorectal cancer, which has spread. I really bless them, don't want to ask them, would you recommend me to a family or friend? You know, they don't want to do that, but I just want them to get the best care. So the better questions is, are you being treated with dignity? Are you involved in your care decisions? Are you the one shaping your care plan? So, conclusion. I think quality underpins everything, but often in community, it's something that quality indicators happen to the community nurses. We kind of get asked to measure certain things and how to measure them. We really need to take to the forefront of shaping how we design, how we measure things. And there's a lot of evidence that needs to be put into shaping and changing what measurements we use. And we're key in making sure that we use the right evidence and we shape the quality indicators. Thank you.
In view of all the debate this morning, our next speaker is Jan Coughling, who his background is in care of the older person and general practice, but she is now currently a nurse caring for the homeless in Swansea. I'm sure people that are here this day will be fascinated by her session. She presented it this in Manchester and it got a good response there, and some interesting works come out of her piece of work. So thank you, Jan, over to you.
Thank you. Normally at this point I say what a pleasure and an honour it is to have been asked to contribute, but that's until I realised a couple of days ago that it was being live streamed, and suddenly it's not such a pleasure. I'm actually feeling very hot and flustered. However, bear with me. As has been said, I'm the nurse for homeless and vulnerable adults in Swansea in South Wales. I really love hands-on work. Working with people who are homeless, vulnerably housed, it's not that difficult, actually. It's challenging, yeah, but actually any nurse could and should be able to look after patients like mine. The essential part is just about treating patients with respect and dignity and providing them with the same high-quality care that you would give to any other patient. Yeah, you've got to be a bit more flexible about the approach and you've got to get other people on board to help, but it should be the same quality of care. So, I like that picture. I never apologise for the pink bra, by the way, because we were doing a session on breast awareness, and at the end of the day, everybody had got the message. I felt a bit of a prune, but, you know. So how do I go about improving care for my patients? Well, in common with lots of other areas in the UK, we've got huge problems with alcohol misuse in Swansea. We've got around 7,000 heroin-dependent people, and only at any one time we can only have 650 people on methadone treatment, which means that we've got about 6,300 and odd, or more or less, who would like to be on a methadone script probably, but can't have one. We've also got an increasing number of people in their 30s and 40s with alcoholic liver disease, We've got lots of homeless people, some living in hostels, some living in wet houses. Wet houses are where you, it's a supported living environment where you're allowed to continue drinking or using drugs within reason on the premises, as opposed to a dry property where you can't use alcohol or drugs on the premises and would risk eviction if you did so. We've got such a high incidence of drug dependency. We've also got huge problems with injecting drugs and hepatitis C. And we've got lots and lots of sex work going on in Swansea. Most of it we've discovered recently with our new sex worker project, that the vast majority of it seems to be connected to people needing to get money to fund their drug habit, which was not quite what we'd expected. And we've also got some of the worst poverty in Wales. So in order to develop and improve the services for the group, what I first did was look at some of the issues and try to identify some of the gaps in services. So how do you do that? Well, I like audit, and lots of people think I'm a bit mad, but I like audit where there's something at the end of it, and it's not because somebody told you to do the audit. I think that audit helps to really clarify the issues. And when I'm not being the nurse for homeless people, I am actually a nurse advisor for primary care quality with Public Health Wales. And it's my job to assist in the development of audit and quality improvement tools for doctors and nurses. So I think it's really a very useful tool. I also like case reviews and critical events. I think they're extremely helpful in identifying the gaps in services and the areas where things need to be improved. My quality agenda is always dictated by the patients and those close to them, and rarely by people, if ever, by people in suits telling me that that's what I've got to do. But patient and carer feedback can be quite scary sometimes, and particularly when you work with alcoholics and drug users. But it's really important to listen to what patients are telling you, and I know you will all know that when you go into people's houses, that sometimes what it is that they want or that they're telling us is not what you expected, and it's important to listen to that. Finally, the last weapon is research. I'm told that I should refer to research as a tool, but as I said earlier, not in my hands when I want something changed. So this is one of our more recent improvements that's come about when we noticed that the alcohol-dependent patients weren't taking vitamin B and thiamine. I won't go into the neurological workings of these things, but basically thiamine you need as a coenzyme in the brain, and if you don't have it when you're an alcoholic, you can fry your brain and end up with a really nasty condition called Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Really important that people take it. So the practice that I work with spend a lot of time and effort giving out prescriptions for vitamin B and thiamine, and when I talk to people, said, have you been taking your vitamin B and thiamine? And they said no. And I said, oh, why is that then? Well, it tastes disgusting, nurse, doesn't it? And you belch yeast for hours afterwards. So when I did an audit and had a look, that was indeed the case, is that we'd been busily prescribing this stuff. Some of them had been busily ordering it and taking it home and stockpiling it, but the vast majority weren't taking it at all. So what we did was to offer intramuscular Pabrenex injections, this high-dose vitamin B and C, to those who were most at risk of developing problems related to their alcohol and who didn't want to take the drug orally. And the real surprise was that people turned up. They actually wanted to have their injections. And they said, oh, yes, nurse, be along. And they would turn up for the 10 days that they needed to, there or thereabouts. Some of them, you know, missed a few days but came back. Some people came twice on one day, but they didn't get those. But it's been a massive success. It's been a success because people are now understanding about memory loss, but also coming in and saying, my nurse, my memory's got a bit better. I am feeling better. And also complaints about neurological symptoms in their feet and so on have gone down. It's been such a huge success, in fact, that we've now got a patient group direction for Pabrenex that can be used opportunistically. So if someone on the outreach team in the morning tells me that they've met somebody who is an alcoholic, new on the streets, they can come in and they can be given a course of Pabrenex, which often is enough to make people feel well enough to get them to engage on a regular basis. And that's important too. As I said, I like case reviews, and this chap was an amazing young man who kept going to A&E for his fits. And he had 16 attendances in 1 month, and A&E said, "Oh, we've had it. We're so fed up with this chap. Can you sort it out?" So I went down to the wet house, and I said to him, "Right, tell me about your medication. You're on all this sort of anti-epileptic stuff, and you're supposed to be on your vitamin B and thiamine, and, you know, get me." And he produces two big carrier bags, which he came into the room with, absolutely full to the brim with medication. And I said, how do you take all this medication? And he said, "I don't." I said, "Why don't you take it?" He said, "I can't read and write, nurse. No idea how to take it." He said, "I don't know what it is." So I said, "Well, do you take it at all?" He said, "Oh, occasionally if I've had a fit, I'll take some." And I thought, ah. So I said to the hostel staff, "Ah, come on, what's happening here? Shouldn't you be helping him with this medication?" "Nothing to do with us. We don't touch medication. We're a support agency. We're not allowed to handle medication. We cannot touch it. We can't open the boxes for him, and we can't sort it out into a dosing tray." So what we did was we organised a dosing tray, and then staff could then say, "Have you taken your medication? I see you've not remembered to take medication today." And this, within 2 weeks, his seizures had completely stopped, gone down. I think he'd had three, within a month, he'd only had three fits. And these corresponded to when he'd actually run out of money for alcohol. But when I checked with the other hostels, this wasn't a one-off problem, because other hostels said exactly the same thing. They were not allowed to have anything to do with medication at all. So one of the things that we did, we got on board a large pharmaceutical company, a pharmacy chain, who came along and said, "Look, we'll do dosing boxes for anybody that wants one within the hostel." And it's been great, because what it's done is made sure that people are taking the medication as they should be, and it allows staff in the hostel to check whether or not the medication has been taken as prescribed. And that applies to things like, you know, antihypertensives and all the rest of it that people may have been less compliant with. The other issue that was really important was that staff in the hostels thought that every time somebody had a fit, that they had to call an ambulance. They had no idea that for the vast majority of people, that they can be safely managed. If they've only had one fit, and providing it's not their first, they recover all right afterwards, so it's perfectly okay for them to stay in their own home. And staff had not understood that, and often the hostels had procedures in place which meant that they had to call an ambulance. And what we've had to do is to train the hostel staff to change that. We've just recently re-audited the A&E data, and that's shown a huge reduction in attendances for seizures for those living in the hostel's wet houses. But there's one man I'm going to have to catch up with him soon, because he's really messing up my statistics, because he's currently out on the streets and he keeps losing his dosing box. The other really interesting area that we've recently got into is end-of-life care. I had not understood when I started this job how soon I would come into contact with people I've got a lady at the moment who's 35 years of age with terminal liver disease. And I'd not understood quite how they would often, I assumed that they would stay in the hostel or whatever until they died, but in fact, that's far from the case. What we have is a whole series of problems with people going into hospital to have their ascites drained, but leaving because they've not had any alcohol, and that they're fed up with the hospital staff, and then people then being admitted last few weeks of their life, but being in for long periods of time when actually they could have been managed at home. So what we decided to do is to work with the palliative care team and the hepatology ward and kind of iron some of these problems out. And the first thing we did was we talked to the hepatology ward and said, at what point do you start talking about end-of-life care or palliative care to your patients with alcoholic liver disease? And they said, oh, usually about a week before they die. Well, we don't now. As soon as you tell them that they've got alcoholic liver disease and you say, if you are not going to stop, these are the consequences. And hey, would you like to meet, in my case, my friendly palliative care nurse, Jen, who is going to start working with you to look at, you know, what help and care and support we can provide for you. The other thing that we did was we established a care pathway for ascites. One of the things that was happening is people have got a belly full of fluid. They need to go in. They wouldn't go in because they couldn't drink. And then it was chaos, and they'd come out again, and they hadn't had it done, and then they'd have to be admitted acutely and all sorts of things. So we decided that what we would do now, they're allowed to have a alcohol of some description at midnight before they go in. But the palliative care nurse organises the day case, the day ward for them to go in and have it done. I go the day before and take the blood that they require, so there's none of this messing about. It's all organised. The staff go with them from the hostel and stay with them throughout the procedure and on the ward, and then they carry a can or some alcohol with them in their bag, and as long as they're not having a sly drink during the day, as soon as they're ready to go, they can go and they can have their drink on their way out. And that's been brilliant. People are coming in and having their ascites drained on a regular basis now, and it works well. But one of the most effective things that we've done is to give the hostels some support for the work that they're doing. And St Mungo's, if you've not seen this document, it's absolutely amazing. The St Mungo's document on palliative and end-of-life care. And this has been brilliant because hostel staff are now saying, no, he's going to stay at home. And they're determined to keep people at home in the hostel. And they don't want the patients to go to hospital unless the patients want to go to hospital, until their residents want to go. And that's been amazing. So consequently, my 35-year-old lady at the moment is doing very nicely, thank you, at home, and is the most positive and the most calm, cool and collected that I've ever seen her in all her life. She's doing really well. As I said to you, research can be a very powerful weapon in the fight against poor quality. When I started 7 years ago, this is a regular thing that I used to see. People's mouths, absolutely horrible. And I went to the health board and I nagged and nagged and nagged, and that didn't work. So I found myself an interested professor of dentistry who was practicing locally. And what I did was a piece of research with him, which was based on something called an oral health index. And what we did was we asked people, did they have problems eating, smiling, were they uncomfortable about their mouth, did they have problems chewing, you know, all sorts of stuff. And basically you score that, and then the higher the score, the worse the oral health is. So the oral health index in Wales at the time was 5. The index in a group of homeless people in Northern Ireland was 16. In my patients it was 29. So we published the work. And hey presto, that's what we got. The health board were powerless to resist, and we've now got a dental service. It's only once a month, but it's mobile, and they park up in a place that suits us, and we have it, you know, people are getting dentures. I've got people smiling at me for the first time in a long time. So these are just some of the many projects and aspects of care that we deliver. As I say, I just collect data through research, audit, case reviews, patient pathways, and just look at the gaps in services. The rest is about being driven by the patients and about wanting to improve quality of care for them. Sometimes we make a very, very small change in practice that has a huge outcome for the patients, and that's actually good for all of us. This is quite an easy piece of reading for those who are interested in quality improvement. In Wales, we've got the quality improvement guide that you can download from the internet. Thank you very much for listening.
We have some questions, but I just think I need to summarise the two presentations this afternoon. I think Ben's really given us a realistic view of measuring quality in clinical everyday practice and how he integrates that into practice. And Jan's given us some very practical examples of how you can improve the quality of care for patients. I think what's come out of the two sessions I've heard this afternoon and the sessions this morning is very much that we do need that focus on supporting practice in community care with some research to support how we're making a difference to patients. And all the sessions this morning obviously alluded to that need for clinical academic careers and pathways to improve the evidence base for care we provide in the home for patients. So thank you, Ben and John. That was a very interesting session. So do we have any questions from the audience first? I can see with the light, it's quite glaring. Is there any questions? There's a Candy at the front. Is there microphones? Question?
Hello, thank you. I'm Candice Pellett, Senior District Nurse. Just one quick question. I probably should know the answer to this. Why is the methadone treatment limited to just over 600...
Resources. It's simply resources. Okay. Yeah, it's quite time consuming and expensive to deliver methadone. Because people have to collect it every day, and pharmacies have got to dispense it, and so on. So the resources is very strictly limited.
So how would you choose, if I'm allowed a second question? Because I guess that's quite an ethical.
Unfortunately, I don't have to choose, which is jolly good for the health board. Because if I had to choose, we wouldn't be. You know, we'd be constantly arguing, I think, because you have to make a decision based on need. You have to prioritise patients. So pregnant women would be prioritised, people where there are children in the family and there are safeguarding issues, they would be prioritised. And then people with significant ill health. All the consultant from the community drug and alcohol team does, when I write her a letter saying, this patient has recently had, a stroke as a result of mitral valve disease brought on by the fact they've had septicemia and they're still injecting, will you please do it? And she's just, not another one of your letters, because then the patient then has to be prioritised. But it's a very difficult situation, yeah.
There's another two behind you.
Hi there, I'm Kerry Berham. I'm Clinical Team Lead and Complex Case Manager in Lincolnshire and a Queen's Nurse. Really, really interesting presentation. Certainly some work I'm doing with GPs in my area is around looking at high-intensity users and those types of patients who are at high risk of using secondary care services. And consistently, the first 10 lot of people are your... people with dependency, either alcohol or drug. Now, certainly in my area, middle of Lincolnshire, homelessness isn't quite so much of an issue. But these are still the patients that, you were just talking about. I'm thinking those are patients there. They don't traditionally fall onto the community nursing, district nursing caseload, but there's still clearly a need there around that hospital avoidance. Now, certainly something I've spoken with the GPs around is that we need to be getting the other services in to do the same bit that I'm trying to achieve as well. And from your experience, what other stakeholders, what other professionals do we need to be bringing in to be having these conversations to help support these people?
Anybody will work with you. I mean, that's what it's... you just need to... I've got chums. You need chums. You have to get friends, and you have to... I have a Christmas card list, and people move up and down it. you've got to be able to work with people. That's what it boils down to. You have to be able to make the case for making the changes that you want to make and get people on board.
So it's looking at who's the drug and alcohol services?
Drug and alcohol. It may be that you actually need to talk to third sector. You need to talk to the charities who are out there providing loads of care in hostels and wet houses. They will tell you.
We haven't got those. That's the thing. In my area, in particular, it's very rural.
Yeah.
So if you went to Lincoln or Skegness or Boston, you've got those facilities.
But if you're rural, then it's the community drug and alcohol team. It would be looking at... I would be... if you've got people out in the rural areas who are using drugs and alcohol, then they may not be even known to the drug and alcohol teams. So it would be the GP, perhaps. It might be that you need to make the case for some assessment of those things. So it could be the mental health team, because a huge number of people with mental health problems will be using drugs and alcohol in order, self-medicating and so on, self-harming. As a consequence of that. So you can quite often find ways around, or chums of your own?
I'll start building some chums.
Okay.
Thank you.
So there's a question there.
It's Amanda McKendry, clinical lead from Oxford Health. It's a question for Ben. Ben, I was just wondering around patient experience and patient voice. For community nursing, how do we do that for the very frail 90-year-old who's behind closed doors and no one ever sees them and they can't get to any of those patient experience groups? And that's a measure of the quality, but how do we find out for those very, very frail people?
They're the sort of people who tend to fall between the quality measures we use. It's really important to make sure that we speak up for their needs. I mentioned outcome indicators, and an awful lot of patients we look after in the community, they don't fit into any outcome. You can't say, well, actually, this person, if we get the care they need, their leg ulcer will heal. It may be that their leg ulcer will heal, but they're still socially isolated and very frail and at risk of falling and at risk for chronic heart failure. And actually, it's the patients who can indicate their best outcomes. And PROMs, patient-reported outcome measures, they're the sort of keys that we need to be using. And it's identifying, rather than it being led by, say, the commissioners of what indicators, make sure that the patients' groups are involved in that and make sure that the clinicians we are. It's often the district nurse who mop up people's needs who don't get met by any other service. And we've got to change it round and actually say, this is a very, very at-risk patient group, or several at-risk patient group. I always think of a patient with leaky legs. Kind of, where do they fit? And actually, they're the people who really genuinely need us, and we need to go, these are the indicators, they're reported by the patient, of how satisfied they are with their care, how much independence they feel they've been able to retain. And it's using those indicators.
But they might not be the indicators of the very frail 90-year-old, because they may not actually be able to even report that experience.
Our occupational therapist colleagues are really quite far advanced in outcome indicators compared to nursing. And they debate amongst themselves which tools they got which are most valid to a situation. I think there's a lot we can learn from our colleagues in the allied health professions. And it's worth looking at their work.
Any more questions in the room? Have we got any from the streaming? No questions. Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Ben and Jan, for a wonderful session.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.